we stopped somewhere obvious, but I don't remember where.
Yes. So let me just start out for the transcription. Today is March 27th. It is day two of the oral history interview with Mary Gall. I'm again Hillary Domisch, and with me is Mike Ronsky. So yes, we did. We stopped. We were talking about your work in information and library sciences, I believe at Roman Haas. Mm-hmm. You had moved into this position, the senior librarian, the woman who read the technical reports and the journal articles to this chemist who was blind. She had retired because she had reached the mandatory retirement age. And you kind of moved into this position. And I wanted to start out by asking a little bit about how you got into the library from the laboratory. Because it doesn't necessarily seem obvious how one would make that switch. For so many years, you had been, as you said, hands in the laboratory.
I've been trying to think of how it worked out. In part, I think it may be that they just felt like I wasn't very useful in the laboratory. Maybe that was it. Okay. Or that maybe this would be a more productive position to be in. So okay. That's all I can think of.
Do you recall, I was a little bit worried that perhaps it was something like they were trying to move you as a woman out of the laboratory and into the library because maybe someone thought that that was more suitable.
I don't think that was it. I think the more suitable was maybe they thought my abilities would be better used. At that run, two of my friends there were women PhD chemists, and this is, you know, the obvious thing of how I was aware that they were definitely discriminated. One of them, I'll describe her, was, shall we say, the heavy one.
Okay.
She was physically, and she said that she found that she had no trouble with, you know, with people as being head of a small laboratory group. She did not find that there was a problem with the men who worked under her, but there was apparently a certain amount of resentment, which obviously she became aware of. Mm-hmm. The other PhD, I'm trying to remember what work she had, but anyway, she was, I think that each of them was very smart, but I don't remember what the other one did. Maybe I'll remember in time.
Okay. But it wasn't any discrimination that you were aware of against you to facilitate this move.
I think this is maybe a position that they thought they wanted to have filled or that, and then the time things are not clear to me, but about this time I had my thyroid problem arose, and I had a subtotal thyroidectomy.
Okay.
And as a result of that, until they finally was very soon, they recognized the fact that I had to have artificial thyroid. Mm-hmm. So I've been on artificial thyroid ever since. But during the time after the operation and until the doctor realized that I couldn't get this, I would fall asleep.
Yes.
easily. And at that time also, I would be freezing cold when the temperature was about 100. So then once they got me on the synthetic thyroid, then everything, shall we say, stabilized again.
That's so good.
And maybe that had some influence, but I can't remember the time frames.
Okay. So, were you Were you excited at kind of the new challenge of moving out of the lab into the library? Because it certainly required all of your technical knowledge still. Yes.
Well, in part, I guess I was, I don't know, I thought, I was sorry when Helen Tucker, who was the one that in a way I replaced, I was sorry that she was not still there,
right.
Because she would have been a big help to me. But what I was doing was writing. When I got into this position, then I ended up, you know, writing short pieces about various patents that were of interest, I thought, and I don't remember how the thing got circulated. I know it was typed up. I mean, so. And I don't recall whether I did any proofing, and I don't know whether it was to whom it was distributed. Probably the laboratory, the various chemists in the laboratories, but I don't know.
Now, you said also at this time that there weren't any computers or anything like that. Everything was paper and typewriter, and you sorting through the patents by hand.
Yes. I did not have to do any typing. There was a secretary who did all that stuff.
Okay. Now, if you wrote up an abstract of sorts for one of these patents, and maybe a couple months later, a chemist came in and said, you know, you wrote about such and such patent. I need information about this. How did it work? How did you know where all of those things were? Without computers.
The picture you're developing was not anything that I was aware of.
Okay.
They say once Helen Tucker retired, and then my friend Frank Glavis came in. I mean, this was, shall we say, the person that if I influenced anybody, I influenced him.
Okay.
By what I picked, or what he asked me to do, or or what I picked up. From journals, technical journals, that he would be interested, that I knew was certain he'd be interested in.
Okay.
And because of Frank, I even learned, not fast, but I also learned to write and read Braille.
Oh, wow.
Well, he was blind.
Right.
And I thought at least this would be a way that I could communicate with him other than the telephone, which, of course, I wouldn't know if he was there or not.
Right.
So it's a skill that I have not, I have not tried to revive. I still think I can do a little bit, but it's a challenge.
How interesting. I must say, I don't know anyone where Braille is their second language that they speak and read.
I think it might be my third language.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, yesterday you mentioned that all the years of Latin, the years of French, the little bit of German.
Yes. Well, the German was because in order to have a American Chemical Society certification I don't know what they called it, but anyway, to be certified for. I don't know what they called it, but anyway, in order to qualify for that, one had to have German.
Mm-hmm. Right, from your undergraduate degree.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's no longer the case.
Yes, I'm sure it's no longer the case. But the thing that I found interesting about German, particularly reading the German patents. I seem to be more patent oriented than I was articles in German. But you'd start the sentence or something, the description of in the patent at the top here, and then eventually you'd find the verb down here somewhere.
Yes.
I thought German was a trying language.
Yes, German was the language that I studied when I was in undergraduate, and I never studied anything else, so I have no comparison, but it was difficult.
Oh, God, they put these big, these nouns that are
yes.
3 yards long.
Yep, you can just stick a bunch of nouns together and make a new word. Yeah,
but
that was
the fact
that
you finally found the verb down here somewhere, it used to get me.
Yeah.
I don't know about articles, because I never tried them. I never had to abstract them, but the patents were the challenges.
Now, when you moved from Romanhaus to Mobile, you moved in your capacity in the library, in the information science area, is that correct?
Not really, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how I got to Mobile. I mean, I have my suspicions because one of my friends was a chemist at Mobile, and I think they were maybe when they were looking for somebody, and he knew me, and so he suggested that I should. And so it ended up that the transition from Romanhaus to Mobile was like over the weekend.
Oh, wow.
Which sort of disappointed me, because I thought it'd be nice to have a nice vacation, but
yeah.
I didn't get one. So walked in and where was I put first? I guess I was not in any laboratory. I was right in the beginning, actually the brand new beginning of the information science.
Wow.
And this meant computers, and also the fact that they sent me up to New York for take a course in how to manage some of these databases.
Do you recall which databases?
Oh yes, they started out with since it was a petroleum company, they started out with the, I'm trying to think of the name anyway, there's one petroleum database that, and then once you get into the, once you log on to the thing, then you can get, I guess you can get into the various other databases. But in the beginning, it was once I had the course up in New York somewhere about how to manage some of these things, then it was another real learning experience to try to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
Because among other things, this worked in the way you had to do it by words, you had to do it by recognized by the database words. They had their own vocabulary, and so that took a while.
Did you leave Romanhaus voluntarily, or was there a layoff?
Oh, this is a layoff. This is my first or second or third firing, you might say. This was what they called a RIF, and about 20% of the research people were let go. It turned out, in my case, to be financially somewhat advantageous, because they still had the mandatory retirement for women of 60 and men 65, and because I was not in that, not very close, actually, I don't think, I was credited with, I don't know, there's something or other, so I ended up with considerably more money.
Okay.
As a retirement benefit.
Yeah.
And which also included, because of some sort of a pension plan, which also included stock. Hmm. So that's how I started getting stock of Romanhaus. I guess we might say financially I made out all right.
Yes. Well, and certainly if the benefits worked out in your favor and you were able to,
yes,
you know, start a new position at Mobile right away.
Yeah. That was, I'm not sure whether they, it was that they recognized they needed somebody. I was not put in the library. It was a separate area, separate set of rooms. And that, but then, as I say, it was like going back to school again, because one had to learn how to use the computer and how to use all these different databases. The petroleum one was worked on keywords, so you couldn't just go in. Nowadays, you just go in and with any question you want, you get an answer to. But there, you had to go in with specific words,
right,
that are in. We had a like a manual thesaurus that you could look up the sort of things that you could ask. And there the one of our main problems was the computer, where all the computer working things were in California.
Oh.
That was there, and their time zone and our time zone was different, and so you were generally totally frustrated. You were burning up the wires or the but before they got to work, that you could ask questions or find out why something was down. So
the actual computers, the physical computers, were in California?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Interesting.
Well, I guess it, well, anyway, the whole thing was handled there, and to the point where one of the things that, you know, when you have a bank account or you have a credit card, you have to have a password.
Yes.
So I used the zip codes for the California group.
Oh.
I figured how many people knew the zip codes for the.
That's funny. Probably not many.
No.
Did you ever have to go out to California as part of work?
No. I had been there because of American Chemical Society. I was a counselor, and I went to most of the Chemical Society meetings, and at least one of them was in somewhere, maybe Los Angeles, possibly San Diego, but I think it was Los Angeles.
Well, I certainly want to talk about ACS, but not quite yet. I want to hear a little bit more about the information sciences and the work with the computers, because I'm so intrigued about kind of this world of early computers. Now we, of course, rely on computers so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from some of the other information science oral histories that we have that people, not only did different companies work with different databases, and you had to use, you know, these specific vocabulary keywords because databases only had such a, you know, this was a vocabulary and didn't recognize things outside of it. But of course there were also certain rules that the computers understood and rules that they didn't. So if you typed in a keyword, could you use and, or could you say not? Things like that to make your searching more specific?
I really don't remember that part.
Okay.
But you had to use the formal words that were in the thesaurus.
Thesaurus, yeah.
Yes. And it was a big, rather large book that you had to consult to find. And the computers or the databases that at that time, you could not just ask a question. You could not just type in a word and find out. You generally got nothing back. I mean, you couldn't just ask for, say, you couldn't say Roman Haas, and you wouldn't get something back. Hmm. I don't remember what happened, whether just nothing happened or some error message came.
Now, in the time that you were at Mobile and you were working with these things, did you have to go back to New York, you know, repeatedly to update your classes and your training, or was it just that one time?
It was just 1 week.
Okay.
It was a whole week, and there was another, at least one other person, a man whose name I don't remember, from Mobile.
Okay.
And the two of us there. Maybe there were others from other parts of Mobile, but I don't remember.
Okay. Did you ever, you mentioned yesterday knowing Eugene Garfield.
Yes.
Did you have any contact with other people in the Philadelphia area, other chemical companies or other universities maybe, who were starting to get into this information science field and starting to use the computers and the databases and things like that?
Well, I must have, because, you know, we're a small group, really. And I did know some of them. Sandy Burcham was one of them, and I think she's still working in the field. And I'm not sure how to spell her name, but I'm sure she's in. Easily found.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of. Certainly, we would get together at various things like, not just meetings for the chemicals, for the information people, but just like the monthly meetings of the Chemical Society. This is the local one,
right?
And I think this is where a lot of us got, you know, talked and exchanged information.
Hmm.
So,
now, since ACS has already come up a couple of times, just in the short time we've been talking today, you are a long-time member of the American Chemical Society. When did you first join ACS?
Probably shortly after I got out of college.
Okay.
Then there was a time when I actually physically resigned from the society.
Oh.
I wrote the letter to Holden Emery, I guess it was at the time, because they had raised the dues, and I said I couldn't afford it. And I don't remember what the result of that was. I don't think they ever really dropped me, but in spite of my, throwing them away.
Yeah. Now, you've been very active in the Philadelphia mm-hmm. American Chemical Society. Tell me a little bit about what the meetings of the Philadelphia American Chemical Society were like, and what kind of things that you did.
We started out with most of them at that time were held at either the Franklin Institute or out at the Penn at the museum, and they always started out with a social hour first, and then dinner, and then after dinner there would be a technical talk by somebody. Sometimes there was a separate dinner talk, and at one time they tried their best to have programs, separate programs, that would interest the wives of the chemist. But that worked for a while, but you know, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of enthusiasm to get something like that really going.
Right. And of course the assumption with that is that the wives of the chemists are not chemists themselves.
Yes, because if they were chemists, they would just be part of
part of the regular
group. Right.
Okay. Now, when you were going to these networking meetings fairly early on, did it seem like most of the people were from academia or industry? Because, of course, here in the greater Philadelphia area, there's so many universities and colleges, but also so much industry, whether it be petroleum or chemical.
My feeling was they were all industrial.
Okay.
I don't remember academic people.
Hmm.
If they were there, I didn't. They didn't register on my radar.
And of course, the next question is, do you recall how many women were there? Was it just a couple, or was it hard to tell because men brought their wives?
You mean at the regular monthly meetings?
At the regular monthly meetings.
Well, the people, the women who were chemists generally came.
Okay.
I mean, the two that I knew quite well from Roman Haas, they were generally there. In fact, I think one of them often was the one who ran the social hour.
Hmm.
Running the social hour means that you have to somehow or other get the liquor. You have to make arrangements to get it to the meeting place and so forth. Because there was one wonderful story when all the things for the social hour were in the trunk of my friend's car, and it was she was one of the Roman Haas chemists, and the car was parked in a parking lot just beyond the railroad tracks, and there was a train which just stopped right across the
blocking.
They went. I think they went. Dashed up and found the engineer and asked if he could move the train, but he looked at them like, you know. And so they ended up passing over the couplings between two cars and all the stuff that for the social hour.
And the social hour was saved that day.
Yes, saved.
That's funny. So it certainly seemed like you were not the only woman at the ACS local meetings, that there were others.
Yes.
But I'm going to assume that it was a minority.
Definitely a minority. The efforts of getting the male chemists to bring their wives was mostly not successful. Very occasionally it was the few times that I think we offered an alternative program after dinner that really interested them. One of them was on jewelry, another one was, and some of them were also attracted some of the men too.
Yeah.
Yes. The jewelry one was fascinating. I can sort of remember that. And what was one of the other ones? I don't remember, but there was at least two of them that, the second one I'll probably eventually remember, that were interesting enough to draw out the non-chemist women, generally the women. But as I say, most of the time, the meetings were definitely male.
Mm-hmm. And those meetings were more monthly or every couple months?
No, monthly. I think it was the third Thursday. It was every month except summertime.
Oh, okay. Kind of on the academic calendar, even though it was mostly industrial people.
Yes.
I guess people go away for vacation still.
Well, it just wasn't practical. And they had the meetings. Monthly meetings were often designed around something such as giving awards to high school students, or one of the ones was for chemistry teachers, and then there was another one for the 50-year members.
Okay.
50-year members of the ACS, and things like that. So the meetings were generally, they were organized every year by the chairman-elect of the section.
Now, did you serve ever on any of the official roles in the local ACS?
I was a secretary for two times.
Okay.
And then they, shall we say, they twisted my arm and got me to do it a third time. But I said that was enough. I'm not a stenographer or anything like that, but I developed a speed writing type of thing. And then we had the section had an official secretary who would then transcribe things so that they went into the monthly Catalyst publication.
Well, and I imagine that you'd been going for so long, you probably knew a lot of the people very well, so it was probably easy to, it's always easier to take notes when someone's speaking when you know that person, know the way in which they speak.
But as I say, we had a paid secretary of the section, and she would, I'm sure, correct things that I didn't get right, or just expand on them so that the minutes of the meeting were legible.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you recall if the industrial people, your fellow chemists who were at the local ACS meetings, were these laboratory chemists like yourself, people in information sciences in the chemical industry, or were some of these people higher ups, some of the VPs and CEO types of the local chemical industry?
Well, I guess it, shall I say, the usual answer, it depended.
Okay.
Sometimes there would be a reason to ask, specifically ask somebody higher up, like a research director or something like that. I remember we had Ralph Connor, and he was one of the research directors. And there were others. And then there were, Arthur H. Thomas, the company that supplied chemicals and equipment, things like that. They were very, very active in the section, and I think help sponsor some of the social hours.
Okay.
I think Thomas is still around here, aren't they?
What's I don't know.
I don't know either. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You said very briefly a couple minutes ago that you do think that you went out to California one time for one of the national ACS mm-hmm. meetings. Did you regularly attend the national ACS
yes.
meetings?
Yeah. That was because I was from the Philadelphia section. I was an elected counselor
okay.
from the section. And whichever of the companies I worked for were supported by my efforts and paid my way and allowed me the time. So
okay.
Now I think they have slightly different setup where possibly they can get reimbursed by the main society for people's expenses. But at that time, it was you were on your own.
So did you get to travel to many, many places around the country then? I mean, now
yes,
the
I did,
meeting
both
is
for,
many places.
Both for the ACS and also for the petroleum the chemicals, the Petroleum Institute, since I worked for them. So that got me to places like Houston and various other places. So
I would imagine the Petroleum Institute meetings, many of them are in Texas and maybe along the parts of the Gulf Coast and parts of the West Coast where the big refineries are, if they're not the meetings aren't here, of course.
I know. Well, as I say, that was, I know that was part of the thing that got me position. And I had some position that was why I would be, would travel down to Houston or travel somewhere else.
As part of the Petroleum Institute?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, was that something that you started doing early on? Because you didn't mention that earlier. It hadn't come up yet, the Petroleum Institute.
If I worked for Mobil, you know, you just automatically, your petroleum, and you're automatically tied in with that. And I guess that was part of it. I'll dig around somewhere up here and get some more information.
When you went to the ACS meetings, I've talked with some other people, and they said that when they first went to ACS meetings, and some of them, this was in the 1960s or the 1970s, they said that they used to go to the Women's Chemist Committee lunches,
mm-hmm.
and that they were very small, and of course, over the years that they've been going, they've grown tremendously. And now, at the Women's Chemist Committee lunches, of course, now they have breakfasts and brunches and lunches and things, but at the big lunch, there's usually a couple hundred people there, a couple hundred women. And some of the women I've spoken with said that when they first started going, it was only a handful.
Mm-hmm.
When you were going to these ACS meetings as an elected counselor from the Philadelphia area, do you remember seeing many other women at these meetings, or do you remember
I certainly went to the women chemists luncheons.
Okay.
And there were always an adequate number. It wasn't just a little table full of people. It was, and they always had a speaker. Generally the one who had won the Garvin Medal.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I must have known a lot of them, the women there. Not all of them, of course, but many of them.
Right.
So it was not a little clique. It was a rather large group.
Okay. A decent sized lunch.
Yes.
Okay. And there are people that you saw, these were women that you saw regularly year.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Some of the better one knowns, Mary Good,
mm-hmm.
was one of the better ones and better known ones. And I'll think of many of the others as life goes on.
That would be great. Mary Good, we're lucky enough to have one of her oral histories. One of our oral histories is with her.
I hope so.
Yes, it's a very, very good oral history.
Brilliant woman.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
And also attractive, physically attractive.
You know, I've only ever seen two pictures of her. We have just a couple of pictures of her in our collection. One from very early in her career, and one from kind of the middle of her career. And she of course, she is very pretty, but it's just two pictures. So it's always funny at CHF because people do donate their pictures and things like that to us. The images that we get of people in our minds are just the pictures that they give us, you know. So I have very specific images of all of these chemists in my head, but they're just the photos in our collection. they're not real people, as we say. They're just photos. Now, I know at some point you married John Gall, who I believe was a PhD chemist.
Yes.
Did you meet him through work or through ACS or just...
Through ACS.
Okay.
Because we knew each other already. He was, he was at most of the monthly meetings there, so I think. And he also was a counselor from the section.
Okay.
So I don't ever remember connecting him with the national meetings, but the local meetings definitely. And at some point, somebody said, did I know that he was a widower? And I think maybe this got started at that point. I think I had been going out with another chemist, Jim Jessel. Almost sounds like the right name.
Okay.
who has moved, probably retired long ago, but moved then out to one of the companies in Chicago area. But anyway, John, when we got together, had chemistry as a bond, and also I guess general interest. He got me out of doors since he was very active in a local trail club.
Oh, okay.
And he just liked things like that.
Now, where did he work?
He worked for Penn while it was in. He started out at Pennsylvania Salt Manufacturing Company, which is down on the Delaware, and they became Penn Salt, and then they bought Wallace and Tiernan, I guess, and they became Penn Walled, and I think after he left them, then they also were absorbed by a French company, whose name I don't remember.
Interesting.
So, but he was. At Penn Walled, he was his field was fluorine chemistry, so that he was consulted often for his expertise in fluorine chemistry. He gave talks sometimes at the Chemical Society, the local Chemical Society meetings, and I know he did a lot of traveling for his company, probably. I don't know what was exactly what the purpose was, but he was. I'm not absolutely certain what his position at Penn Walled was, but he was in charge of some section of the research. So
you had this bond about chemistry.
Yes.
Play on words about bonds, but you said that he was interested in hiking and things outside.
Yes, well, he was. I think he was, as I said, got me out of the house into the wilderness.
The actual wilderness, not just outside.
Yeah. Well, among other things, he belonged to a hiking club that a friend of his had gotten into. And after he retired from Penn Salt, he felt sort of miscellaneous for a while. Then he taught chemistry part, maybe full time, at what was then the Textile College, Philadelphia College of Textiles and Science, which now has another name which sounds exactly like the Pharmacy College. They both sound identical, so I don't remember. Anyway, the friend of his there at the Textile College in the chemistry department there was a hiker, and he got John into getting belonging to that hiking club. So the hiking club, which still exists, runs hikes, I guess, on Saturdays and Sundays. Maybe not so much in the summer, but all the rest of the week. And Sundays, of course, are advantageous because of Pennsylvania's blue laws.
Oh.
In other words, no hunting.
Right.
No hunting on Sunday.
No, and that's certainly, you don't want to run afoul of hunters while you're hiking.
No, and the awful thing right now that most of the hiking clubs are, I guess, hoping to reverse the rifle groups. They're trying to get the restriction on Sunday hunting removed, so that people can go shoot you on Sundays.
Interesting. Well, I don't want any hikers being hunted accidentally. You have to wear orange, the color of my folder.
Anyway, so he was, not only was he active with a local hiking club, he also got, I guess I should say, arm twisted into being the one who, well, it was a long story, but anyway, he took over from somebody else who had been doing the work on the Appalachian Trail in Pennsylvania.
Oh.
And this person had been the one who had been doing the work on buying the work. The work means that you have to keep monitoring the trail to make sure that it's open. It's not, trees haven't fallen down on it, and that the signs are still visible and things like that. Well, apparently this couple, he was being transferred by the service down to Georgia, so he could no longer do it. So then they had great discussions at one of the meetings of what would they just give it up and hand it back to the big AT, Appalachian Trail. Now the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. They used to be, they added Conservancy on. They didn't use that before. A man at the meeting was a very vocal supporter of the trail, and he was a very, very active hiker, and I should remember his name, but anyway, at that time, one of the oldest people who had ever hiked the trail. They decided, John offered to share the responsibility with somebody else. I don't know who the other person was. And so then that got the two of us involved.
So did you take to the hiking easily? Was it something that you enjoyed? I mean, yesterday you spoke about how when you were little, you know, you would go to Holderness, New Hampshire, and you would spend time with your grandmother kind of hiking around and looking at all the outdoorsy types of things. But of course, as time goes on and one gets busy, things like that often fall by the wayside. So was it something that you were excited to try again?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Well, it was nice to be part of what you might say is a very important major project, mm-hmm. the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Katahdin in Maine, mm-hmm. so that you sort of feel almost privileged to be part of something as continuous and ongoing as that.
Did you get to hike other parts of it other than just the Pennsylvania parts?
Oh, yes. When we were down south, anytime we were somewhere near it, we would hike a part of it.
Okay.
So we always claimed that we maybe if we put all the parts together, maybe we hiked the whole thing, but I think that was a thing. There's parts in New Hampshire that we've done, parts in Maine we've done.
Did you do the Katahdin part in Maine?
No, we never got to Katahdin.
Never got to Katahdin. I've heard that that's beautiful, but I've heard it's a difficult hike.
The way over, though, that you climb Mount Washington and...
Well, the trail goes through Hanover, but it does not go up over Mount Washington. But Mount Washington is something that I have attacked always. Car, cog railway,
mm-hmm.
and foot.
Wow.
I've only hiked up it once.
I've not done any of those things. Mm-hmm. I hiked one of the other presidentials. I think it was Adams. Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty high.
It was. That was my one attempt at hiking.
Well, one of the ones that I really liked was the one he said he hiked, Lafayette.
Okay.
And the Lafayette is also on the group, so that you go up by the flume and get on the ridge trail that goes along, you end up at Lafayette.
Hmm. Now, did you ever get to do any hiking maybe on the West Coast or other parts of the country?
Oh, when we were out there, we would find something. So we've done a very short thing the one that goes, the thing that corresponds to the Appalachian Trail in the West Coast.
The Pacific Coast Trail, the Pacific Crest Trail, one of those perhaps?
Something like that.
Something like that?
I think it's maybe the Crest Trail,
yeah.
But I'm not sure. Anyway.
Well, so it's all supposed to be so beautiful.
But parts of it, I'm sure, are desert by the time you get down to the southern parts of the Appalachians.
Of the Pacific one.
Of the Rockies.
Yeah, I imagine that they are mountainous.
Probably Sierra Nevadas.
Yeah. Well, that sounds very fun. Perhaps it would be a good time for us to take a break. We've been talking for almost an hour, and it seems like a good time to take a pause.
Good idea.